This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Welcome to the Wandering DMs live stream. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today we're going to be talking about Tomb of Horrors, Gary Gygax's legendary high-level dungeon crawl. So I'll start by asking you, Paul, what is your personal experience with Tomb of Horrors?
So I played it. I want to say I played it more than once, but that's not jibing with your memory of running it. So I've definitely... I definitely played it when you ran it, and in fact, that was sort of the moment I got into old school, I think, is, I think it was 2008, Gygax had just died, you sort of, as an in memoriam, ran Tomb of Horrors, and so I played it, and then after that, I eventually bought the module and read through it, and that's my experience, never ran it.
Yeah, so and that is the only time that I've actually run it, as a matter of fact. So I've run it that one time for you and some close friends of ours on two separate sessions. And I constantly kind of have this itch. The way that I would run it today is very different. At that time, I was actually using third edition D&D, which kind of makes the whole process very complicated and slow. I really wish that I could run it with original D&D rules, with our OED house rules, and kind of see how that would run maybe more crisply or differently. And I haven't since that time. It's obviously this, we should mention this live cast is probably going to have quite a few spoilers in it.
Yes,
so
yeah,
if someone does want to play through Tomb of Horrors, you should probably visit one of our other fine videos on the Wandering DMs channel and maybe skip this one for the time being. But that is to say, it's actually a little bit hard to get players nowadays that have never seen the details of Tomb of Horrors, even though I would love to run it again.
So definitely excellent point. I just want to underscore that, we are going to spoil everything about this module, all the spoilers. So get ready. Dan, my memory was that you ran it with first edition AD&D. Is that not true?
I think that was the second session. So okay. This was actually, I believe this was stretched over 2 years, actually. We did it, we started in 08, we got halfway through it, we came back in 09, and I think in 08 I was running it with third edition rules. And then I think you're right, in 09, which is probably the one that you remember better, I came back with first edition AD&D rules, you're right. I think that's what I was doing at the time. Obviously, now I do with original D&D, those kind of heavy-duty rules, I think, really slowed down the proceedings in a way that was not super, super interesting. I guess I'll say the main thing that I learned from that is there's this riddle near the start, and the players, the way it's written, maybe the players find it, maybe they don't. And when I ran it, I was running very, very strictly. The players at that time didn't do exactly the right thing to find it, so I didn't give them the riddle, and I really, really regret that. There was a later time where someone actually used a commune spell, and what I did was I gave them a snippet of the riddle, and the whole play experience totally changed. So it was kind of an accidental experiment, and I really, really wish that I could just give players the riddle out of the box and see how they interact with the puzzles and traps on that basis, because it seemed like much more interesting, much more engaged play. I really regret not doing that. And my top piece of advice would be, any DM running it, give your players the riddle. It really makes for a much more satisfying experience.
My personal memory of that, of course, is one of my favorite anecdotes of playing in a game you ran, Dan, when Dan was reading out the riddle, and... what is it? You made a point, I think a strong point of like, I'm not going to repeat any of this, I'm not going to say it again, you get this once, here it is. And you read out the riddle, and then one of the players said, well, what if What if we had, like, recorded what you said? Would that be okay if I'd, like, written it all down or recorded it in some way? And it erupted into this massive fight at the tables. People were saying, like, it doesn't matter. Who cares? He said, like, let's try to process what he just said. And eventually it came out that the player in question had, in fact, recorded you. Had gotten his phone under the table and recorded your voice and had the riddle ready to go. Hilarious.
That was an amazing moment, and I did allow that, and you know, maybe someone would look askance at that, but I was like, that is so and we've gone through this argument. I could not say no to, so I had to say yes, and the players actually did use the audio recording.
I mean, this,
which again, that's player skill, right? That's what we talk about, player skill.
This brings up a really interesting point about Tomb of Horrors, which. So I recently listened to the podcast Fear of a Black Dragon. It's a podcast where every episode they tear apart a specific old school module. And they did an episode on Tomb of Horrors. And one of the things I think that they got really right, or they touched on, and I would have gone back and really underscored, is sort of what is the play style or the attitude or the setup to playing this game, right? I guess the question is sort of, how serious do you take this? And every time that we played it, Dan, I feel like it was at a convention. You're not playing with your characters you really care about. It was played late at night. And there was a certain kind of tongue-in-cheek humor to it. This sort of like, we know we're about to get in over our heads, and we know that this adventure has this reputation to just crush you, just utterly crush you, and we're in, right? Let's go. Yeah. Let's do this.
Yeah, yeah, and I will say that the riddle, I think, increases that engagement. Without that, you kind of get stuck in a lot of dead ends. And with that, they're like, people are a little bit more aware of the next terrible thing that they're a little bit looking forward to engaging with. So I think that's a really good point. And of course, the adventure was originally written for that kind of tournament situation,
right?
With one-off characters. When it was originally run at what, Gen Con 5 or whatever?
Origins 1, it was.
Origins 1.
Origins 1, okay. In 1975.
That was a lot of the players' first ever experience playing D&D. They had not played any D&D at all. For many of them, not played the game, and they were given these high-powered characters, and that was their first experience of D&D. So it's totally made for that kind of non-campaign situation.
You know,
like used to that.
Another interesting anecdote I've heard about that particular convention, and you know, one of the reasons I love reading old convention modules or reports of old convention module play is trying to evoke for me what was that mid-70s, late-70s D&D tournament scene like, because I think it was kind of a unique beast that we haven't seen since. One of the anecdotes I heard is that it was played over the course of the convention, many sessions of this played over and over and over again, and some of the players started telling each other about things they encountered in the dungeon. So people who played later had some clues that people who played earlier didn't have.
Do you think that that possibly spawned later tournaments having the multi-round structure, like the A modules, with everybody in this time slot is playing the temple above ground, and everybody in the next time slot is playing the temple underground? Do you think that possibly spawned that?
Probably. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Seems logical.
Yeah. I have to share that one of the things that happened when we played through that is an epic memory for all of our players is there's a point where the players have to get into a teeny tiny little spelunking tunnel. So they're all crawling one at a time in a solitary line, and it leads to a dead end, and the players are looking for a secret door to get through it. And in our game, one of the players had a Wand of Wonder, right, in first edition?
That one would have been me. That was me. yes, I was, and I think it was in the front. I was in the front, and you're crawling through this tiny tunnel. And good for Dan, who really setting the scene. And I think at that point it was super late at night. We were all a little punch drunk, and Dan really evoked for us the horror of this sort of army crawling through this tiny narrow tunnel that we had to go single file down for, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of feet.
Yeah,
and then came to a dead end.
Yeah.
And we went, oh, geez, what are we going to do? And so I said, well, screw it. I'll why not? I'll launch the Wand of Wonder. Maybe something good will happen. And the first thing that happened was a darkness spell went off. So now it's completely dark and we can't see anything. And I said, oh, this is no good. Let me try one more time. And the second effect was, of course, fireball.
Which in first edition, of course, compresses into the tiny crawl space and catches every single person, the entire line. They're all burned up.
Yep.
And yeah, that was perfect.
I always like to think of it as we were in this little tunnel, like essentially turning ourselves into little human bullets. So when that explosion happened, boom, out we went.
So that's one of our favorite gaming moments in our play session of Tomb of Horrors. So of course, one of the things that that you discovered before I did, and I guess this came through the recent Art and Arcana publication, is the kind of sequence of inspirations that led to the version of Tomb of Horrors that we all know. So apparently, should I go through this in temporal order? Is that what I should do?
Sure.
Maybe I'll go backwards. So there's the main publication of Tomb of Horrors that most of us know. Prior to that, Gary Gygax had the tournament version of Tomb of Horrors at Origins 1, which is just a couple, well, it's shorter. It's a little bit shorter. And then prior to that, a gentleman named Alan Lucian wrote a five-page adventure called The Tomb of Rehotep, sent it to Gary Gygax, who was wildly inspired by it. And as we get a chance to look at it nowadays, quite a lot more than I would have assumed of the inspirations for it came from Lucian's original work. So it's really fascinating to be able to see that nowadays.
It's important to note, like, even in the final printed module that came out, right on the cover, it explicitly says, the author wishes to thank Mr. Alan Lucian, who was kind enough to submit some of the ideas for this dungeon.
And I would say there's quite a lot. I mean, a lot of the ideas as far as particular traps, puzzles that are notable in Tomb of Horrors, they're all in Lucian's work there.
I had the opposite reaction. I thought there was very little, so I'm curious to hear.
Really?
Give me some examples. What made it all the way through?
Okay, here comes spoilers, everybody.
Yeah.
False tomb, secret door in the bottom of a pit. That you need to get through. Poison spikes in the bottom of a pit. The door to the actual tomb is very similar. The detail work as far as particular wood, stone, gemstones decorating the different tombs, that's actually pretty similar too.
What do you mean by that? I guess that I'm not following. What do you mean by particular gemstone?
Well, Lucian is is more detailed than I would be as far as this tomb. The tomb is built out of obsidian, and the coffin is made out of wormwood with streaked teal something. Okay. And he names specifically all the gem types. And
yeah, no, I remember that.
Yeah,
I remember that one and there's one section of certainly of treasure where he's like, here are all the gems. And it's this laundry list of different types of gems that are in it, which...
Right. And I'm accustomed to reading that from Gygax nowadays, but I feel like that seems to a little bit predate that level of detail in the mise-en-scène.
It struck me as, I want to say that maybe in the DMG or somewhere, there's a table that I can roll on to tell me exactly what type of gems... Mm-hmm. All the gems are, and when I read this, if I put my blinders on and pretended like it wasn't written before any of this other stuff, I would have thought, oh, he just rolled on the table a bunch of times and wrote it all down.
I totally agree, and that is what it looks like you get, but I feel like since it predates it, maybe it actually inspired those tables' existence, maybe?
It's possible, yeah.
So there's that. And of course, the one of the major things that comes out of Lucian's version is the Sphere of Annihilation. So yes. That's kind of a famous horrible magic item that most of us know from the DM's Guide. There is a Sphere of Annihilation in the published version of Tomb of Horrors. Lucian apparently is the one who actually invented that. It's used differently in his version of the adventure. And then that appears in the first supplement to original D&D Greyhawk, and he is thanked for that in the cover matter by Gygax when Greyhawk is published.
Here's the interesting thing I find about the Sphere of Annihilation. If you look at the version that Lucien wrote, and you look at what's in the DMG, it's very similar. Very, very similar. Practically just copied over.
And Greyhawk, yeah.
Okay, great. I didn't look at the Greyhawk entry. One of the interesting things about the Sphere of Annihilation is it has all these rules for control, right? And that's very evocative. When I read that, I always think of, oh, there's going to be some kind of scene where the party and an enemy are fighting over control and pushing it back and forth. And, you know, and it's this, I can imagine that scene happening. Now, I've never actually seen that scene happen in any game before. And the interesting thing about Tomb of Horrors, the way Gygax presents it, is he's trapified it, right? He sort of took that Sphere of Annihilation, shoved it in the wall. When the players stick their hand in here, off comes their hand or whatever. but that whole part of it's gone. And I thought, why? It wasn't until I saw Lucien's version of the Tomb of Ra-Hotep that it finally made sense to me, because he doesn't have it there in the trap. He's got it at the end. And unlike Gygax's Tomb of Horrors, where the Lich is just a floating skull that does horrible, basically another trap, right? Not even a monster. That's the interesting thing I think about Gygax's Tomb of Horrors is there's almost no monsters. Maybe zero monsters, maybe one monster you get to fight.
I agree with one, yeah.
Yeah, and then everything else is a trap. Lucien's ends with, like, here is a big nasty Lich for you to fight. And guess what? He's got a Sphere of Annihilation. And so, I imagine if you ran Lucien's version, there's going to be a big fight scene at the end with this Lich, and you're going to be pushing back and exactly what I always imagined for that Sphere of Annihilation. You're going to be fighting for control and pushing it back and forth.
I totally agree with that. It's a great discovery how Lucien used it. I guess we should also say hello to David Heron, who's currently watching the live cast at this point. Hi, David. Glad to have you.
Notable moment for the Wandering DMs live stream. I think it's the first time we've actually had someone join us live. Welcome, David.
Hopefully one of many.
Yeah.
So, David, you win the medal for that first poster. And I think there's, for me, a lot of stuff in Advanced D&D that didn't really totally make sense until I saw the early Legacy and original D&D, and then I go, oh, I see how those rules work in that context. And I get the exact same thing for the Sphere of Annihilation, Lucien's adventure. Yeah, that's the climax. There's a halfway complicated mechanic. It makes for an interesting climactic scene and very memorable. And it does seem, in retrospect, a little bit questionable Gary taking that climactic element away. I agree that I really like how Lucien used that.
It's interesting, right? Now, Lucien's module, Lucien's adventure, it's much shorter, right? It's five pages, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of rooms. It does have some very nasty traps. I wouldn't say that it is all traps all the time, like Tomb of Horrors, right? It's got some nasty ones for sure, but there's also some fights, and it feels a little more like a difficult high-level adventure.
I agree. Probably, we might guess, inspired by some actual Egyptian tomb. It looks like someone could have possibly looked at an actual archaeological dig and used a lot of that for the geographic layout.
And that's the where my mind went when I saw his false tomb, right? His false tomb, I feel like, is just sort of like, I'm trying to remember now. I think it's just a little room with some treasure and stuff in it, right? There's not anything in there that says this is definitely the end. Unlike Tomb of Horrors, which I think goes out of its way to say, wink, wink, this is it. Here's the end. I swear.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, certainly Lucien's stuff at that time is very minimalist. I mean, the actual key is only two, you know, lined page pieces of paper. It's labeled false tomb. So when I read that, I assume the DM is going to elaborate and actually try to trick you. I assume is what would happen.
I think false tomb was a thing that existed in real, you know, archaeological, you know, ancient Egyptian tombs.
Right.
So that's when I saw it in his. I wasn't even thinking of the Tomb of Horrors one, to be honest. I wasn't like, didn't strike me as like a very clever trick to screw with the players.
Gotcha. It's certainly elaborated in the published version quite a bit.
Now, the other interesting thing is, like you mentioned, Lucian has the other reason I think that we think that it's inspired by a real tomb is he's got two maps. He's got a side view and a top-down view, because there's a lot of play of vertical movement in there. And we lose that in Tomb of Horrors, which is...
True, you certainly don't get the side map. And you, when you blogged about this earlier, you commented on that. I think you had a commenter saying, you know, pointing out some other early examples, but I certainly agree, it's not... I'm not used to seeing side views in most published D&D stuff at that time.
Yeah, I think it's unusual. I think it's unfortunate that it's unusual because I think it's super clever. There was a great module, and I'm going to spoil another module for you guys. Sorry. there's a module written in 2010 that was run as tournament style at Gen Con 2010 called the Stone Sky Delve. And the funny thing about that is the first half of it is your objective is to go explore these caves and map them out. And then they totally screw with you by having it be super three-dimensional. There's like there's both a side view and a top-down GM map. And there's just tons of three-dimensional, vertical, horizontal, weird movement that's very much inspired by real spelunking, which means nigh impossible to map.
Right, right. Some of the, I think, original players of Gygax will say that was kind of always the intent to have halfway complicated maps, that the players were specifically challenged at mapping. I think just the other day I was on a forum and Michael Mornard, who was one of Gygax's original players, I think one of the other people were saying in a complicated situation as the DM, in order to abbreviate things, you might... take the player's map and draw out one of the more complicated locations. And Mr. Mornard's response to that was, no, never, ever, ever do that. It's a violation of Gygaxian principles to ever do that. The players should be confused all the time. So I think that they would love to see complicated caves like that for that purpose.
Yeah. Okay, so what else, I guess, what else stands out to you from your memory of running Tomb of Horrors?
Well, I was unhappy with how our session was slow. I like my games to be more fast-paced than that. So I feel like, the main lesson for me is to give players a riddle. If I compare the, you know, Gygax's tournament version to the published version, one thing I noticed is that riddle got a lot more elaborate. Mm-hmm. A number of things got more elaborate, but I think in his tournament version, the riddle is like about four lines long. It's very sketchy. Kind of like Lucian has these, I guess, three, it's a little hard to read, these three hieroglyphs for three particular directions. And I think Gygax's tournament version, again, has three or four major section hints. And then in the later version I'm more used to, that turns into like a 30-line hint, riddle, taunt from the Lich. And so I think that highlights, he thought that was a really important aspect to how the game was going to be played. And I think that's maybe the number one thing that gets elaborated. So that's one change that I noticed. Yep. And of course, the other thing is the illustrations.
Yeah.
Probably the number one motivation that got me to want to run it is I want to show people illustrations.
Yep.
There's this really elaborate, nice, separate package of artwork that comes with Tomb of Horrors, and I want to show this to players. And you noticed some changes between tournament and published version yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was comparing the tournament version to the published version, the one thing I was expecting to find was a lot of expansion in the published version. Like, that's typical of, like, the A series, and I just assumed they would have added a lot of stuff to pad it out for publication. The funny thing is, if you exclude the illustrations, the published version is only one page longer than the original tournament module. The illustrations are a huge part of the game, I would say. A huge part of the module, part of what makes us want to play it. And I think it's fascinating that, like, we haven't really seen this since, I don't think. I can't think of another case of a written adventure that comes with lots of visual aids that you're supposed to show the players that are tied to the actual content of the adventure.
I've had to think about this for 2 weeks, and I finally came up with the one other example. And the one other example is that Expedition of the Barrier Peaks, Module S3, mm-hmm. by Gygax, also has a separate large illustration booklet. It's the only other one that I can think of.
I'll have to add that one to my reading list.
Okay.
So here's you mentioned that there's a change from the tournament version to the published version. That's true. There are more illustrations in the published version. They're redone by a different artist. That's easily noticeable, right? They clearly had talented staff artists by that point. And I'm trying to remember who. There was one person, I think, who drew all the original for the tournament. I have it here. Tracy Lesh. So certainly they were redone. But one thing I noticed was...
They were redone by people like David Tramp here and Sutherland and people like that, if I recall,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, Jeff D, a bunch of people, I think, actually contributed to those illustrations. So here's the interesting thing that I noticed is in terms of the content of the illustrations, if you look at the original tournament module, a lot of the illustrations are of a trap after it's gone off. So we'll see things like a fighter falling down onto some spikes, or we'll see a chest opening up and a skeleton jumping out of it. When you look at the later illustrations, much more often they're of the room before the trap goes off. And I think that's an important change, because that's, like, clearly the fun is handing the illustration to the players and having them puzzle over it to try and figure things out. So rather than just have it as a visual aid of, ha-ha, here's what happened to you, isn't that cute? Instead, now I'm handing it over and saying, here's what you see, what do you want to do? And now the players are going to spend a bunch of time with that illustration.
Yeah, and we've seen that, and it's kind of a really interesting dynamic that I'm not used to in other games. And I agree, that was a really important switch, the published version, to have the stuff present the room the first time the players walk into it and be able to interact with it and puzzle through it and search the illustration like that. It's a really interesting dynamic to be using this really wonderful artwork for very specific gameplay purposes, and the game turns partly into dealing with that art. Yeah.
I think it really helps too with the kind of adventure it is, right? Again, like I talked at the beginning of sort of setting player expectations of what they're in for. I now wonder if I was going to run it, I might even go so far as to tell players, this is an incredibly deadly dungeon. It is full of horrible, horrible traps. You will have almost no fights.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting. Like we've said, there's one... it's good to set expectations. I might not do that, but I'm not bothered by that.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about that. Like, do you want to go so far as to tell them that it is... Because that's the fun that they're going to have, right, is try to figure out the trick so that you can get on to the next trick, right?
Yeah.
And I think players have to be into that. Otherwise, without that, it can be very frustrating.
I totally agree. It can be improperly presented. It can be very frustrating. I think I've made that mistake myself. Certainly if people come in and think, Tumahar's, it's terribly deadly, I'm going to be fighting mobs of hundreds of monsters... You should probably not have people be surprised by the fact that it's the opposite of that.
It harkens a little bit back to one of Matt Finch's tenets about old school play, which is challenge the player, not their character. You mentioned that Tomb of Horrors was for a lot of people their first experience ever with D&D, which sounds crazy, but I'll point out the way the adventure is written, it is not going to be easier if you have a buffer. More magic itemed character, right? That almost doesn't matter, right? What you need is to be clever and to figure out the trick to how to move past the room into the next room.
100%. And I've heard some people claim that they were run through Tumahari's as a player with first level characters claiming that they successfully made it. And it's within the realm of possibility. So I think that that underscores your point is 100% correct. You could almost give people characters of arbitrary levels, and it's the play would be pretty similar.
There was some anecdote I remember hearing about, like, the most successful group to tackle Tomb of Horrors beat it by basically mobilizing a village of commoners with mining equipment to just go out there and just dig the thing out. Just dig it out. Like, don't engage. Don't engage with the rooms. Just dig.
Yeah, and I think that's how Rob Kuntz, I guess, you know, one of the co-DMs, the Greyhawk Adventure, supposedly that's how his character, Robilar, beat it, too, is he got a whole bunch of mercenaries or something like that and just ran them through it to find all the traps, which I would look for ways to not, I don't find that super interesting myself, but...
It's a funny anecdote. In fact, I may just be regurgitating a bastardized version of that very story. That's funny.
So there's a little detail I should point out. So there is at least one place where there is a monster. Mm-hmm. And one, this is a little bit of a detail, but it pinged my radar. In the tournament version, there's this location with gargoyles. And the tournament version, that room says, scale the number of gargoyles to the number of players that you have. And that change in the published version, there's one particular special type of gargoyle. And I've noticed in a number of early Gygaxian modules, there's a tendency for, in the very first encounter area, to say, scale the number of monsters here to the number of players, and then never ever mention that again for the rest of the adventure. And I, you know, as a very literal person, I come to these texts, and my impression is that Area 5 has seven hill giants. That's the nature of Area 5. And to look at slightly earlier things and see that it was intended to actually scale to the number of players' power level is a very different way of looking at things. And here I see it, at least in the tournament adventure once again, is that it actually is supposed to be scaled, that one particular monster area, to the number of players, and then that actually gets removed in the published version. What do you think of that, Paul?
It's interesting. It almost feels in the tournament module, it feels like to me like a, you know, defensive stance of we're writing this pre-convention and we assume lots of players are going to be there, but who knows, right? Who knows how many people are going to actually show up to the table? So maybe they were trying to defend against that. I don't know.
When you run adventures, do you do that? Like if you are going to run an adventure at a tournament or a campaign, do you dial up and down the monsters depending on how many players you get that night?
Yeah, I think I have done that. I don't think it's like an all the time thing, but I've had usually when things are in an extreme, right? Like if I've written an adventure that's for, you know, eight players and three show up, right? Then I'm like, oh, well, maybe I better do something here. I've also run adventures for wildly different levels than what they were written for with the knowledge of, I'll just tune this on the fly. And so, like, these four orcs become, you know, four giants or 40 orcs or whatever it is at the time I think is going to challenge the players.
Interesting. Yeah, I think in my younger years, I was a lot more literal and I tended to resist that kind of thing. And, you know, I can see there's a lot of situations where that's necessary for a good play experience. But once it's weird for me I would expect that in the adventure frontispiece to say, take this adventure, modify it like how you need. And I find it weird that Gygax keeps putting that in just the first encounter area and never mentions it any other place. So anyway, so that pinged my radar on that.
That is odd, although it's interesting in this case that it is the one and only actual monster to fight. So I don't know what you could say about it being the first when there's no other chance to ever do that in the rest of the module.
As a mathematician, it's a true statement that it's the first location with monster.
I almost wonder, my question is, why include it at all? Why have this one fight? I remember when we were playing it, there was a little bit of tension relief there. Oh, finally a fight. Okay, I know what to do now, right? Like, I've been confused by every room and I've had to, like, twist my brain and, you know, think about clever ways of beating every trick. Now I get to fight a thing. Great, let's do that. And then you never see it again.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point. And particularly that particular section I was running with third edition rules, and the players were way overpowered and just demolished the thing. So it was a kind of weird anticlimactic moment right then.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
It's fascinating. I'm kind of going back to the idea of running it with first level characters. Reminds me a bit of when we played in Bill Webb's game, where we had like 20 first level characters in a dungeon that was known to just be full of stuff that was way too tough for us, which I thought was really clever, because then you have 20 people in a room all trying to figure out how to outthink the adventure.
Right. And to be clear, those were monsters. Those were monsters like a purple worm or a giant squad of ghouls or aboleth or all kinds of horrible things.
Right, sure. But it's interesting, I think, in the way that it sort of sets the tone of the play, right? Like, sort of up front, he told us, all right, you know, life is cheap. You're going to die. This dungeon is way too hard for you. Likewise, I think it would be interesting maybe to play Tomb of Horrors with first level characters. I would then even be tempted to remove that one fight and just say, get out of here. First level characters, because ultimately it doesn't really matter. It's all about, outthink the adventure.
That's interesting. I guess some people have done that. If you do that, I'd like to hear the result of the experiment. If you had a 4-hour session in a tournament right now, which version would you pick to run? The main published version or Gygax's tournament or Lucien's adventure?
Ooh, good question. I don't know. They're all enticing. I'm enticed by the idea of running Lucien's just because it's much more straightforward. It's not all traps. And plus, it'd probably be a surprise to some people because probably not many people have actually read the thing. In terms of the other two, I do like the more minimalist writing style of the tournament module. I like not having to try and gloss over, visually look at a paragraph of text and find the one important detail. So that's really nice. The tournament module also has a lot more that's just written right on the map, which I also really like. However, illustrations in the printed module are way better.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a dilemma. I totally agree with that. I totally agree with what you said. Yeah, and I want to see the illustrations and I want to see people interact with them. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so I think ultimately, probably, if I was going to run Tomb of Horrors as advertised, this is Tomb of Horrors, I would probably run the published one just for the illustrations.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense.
I
should also mention that in this train of different iterations, and of course starting with Alan Lucien's Tomb of Rehotep, after Gygax left TSR in the 90s, he made a different gaming system called Dangerous Journeys. Among the campaign mega adventures he wrote was one called Necropolis, based in a fantasy version of Egypt. The end point is an entire valley full of tombs and dungeons, and the culminating most horrible dungeon of all is called the Tomb of Rehotep. And so, what is that, 25 years later, he touches back upon, again, Lucien's original idea. And I saw him later on when he was asked, Mr. Gygax, if you had to string together the most classic series of Gygaxian D&D adventures, what would that look like? And he would start with Keep on the Borderlands, Temple of Elemental Evil, The Giants, The Drow. And then the very last thing was this Necropolis adventure, actually. He considered that part of his main canon, culminating finally with the final thing any high-level adventurer should possibly confront is Tomb of Rehotep. So weirdly, it kind of bookends his whole oeuvre of starting and ending with this same major thing was the main, apparently the main keystone that Gygax considered for his work.
And now have you read that one, Dan?
I have the Dangerous Journeys version of Necropolis. I haven't read it in a while. I recall it feeling like Tomb of Horrors times two. It's more deadly. It's more insta-death. So I think he cranked it up to 11. And again, at the time, I'm thinking if you're running this as a campaign, which the book alleges it to be, I can't imagine anyone wanting their player characters going through it because it's basically Tomb of Horrors times two. It's really, really brutal.
That's funny. I want to point out there's some things I really love about this module. You know, it is, I think, when modern readers come at it, I think they're going to balk a little bit at it for reasons like what you're saying. One is, like, my players are going to want to bring their characters here. This is instant death for sure. And then also, like, the layout is a bit hokey, right? It's sort of a bit... no one would build a tomb like this, right? Like, no person would ever bury their dead in this horrible, bizarre, traps upon traps upon traps nonsense. You know, I think that's the fun of it is coming to it with that mindset. For me, is coming to that mindset of like, oh, I'm going to see really crazy, over the top things, and I'm going to see if I can survive. One of the things he does though that I love, and I think would translate well into any adventure, is, you know, I love that there's this tone of, you know, there's this horrible lich at the end, right? The whole point is go find this horrible, horrible lich that you have to, I guess, destroy. I guess that's your motivation.
And get money.
Yeah. Okay, great. But we're going to try and find the lich. And the lich is kind of present repeatedly throughout the module. Without being physically present, he leaves messages, he taunts you, right? There's the fake version, there's the room where he talks to you, where he's got stuff written on the wall, there's the riddle, right, which is kind of him talking to you.
It's signed by him, yeah.
It's like the most foreshadowed villain, I think, of any D&D module. And I love
it. I agree. And obviously that made a big impression. That actually is well done. The current D&D 5th edition offering, there's some kind of big book adventures they make now. Mm-hmm. What is like Wheel of Destruction or something like that. And...
okay.
We'll look it up and put it in the comments. But anyway, it's that same lich, right?
Yeah.
So they brought him back as like a cosmic traveler trickster, and he's made another 10 times larger mega dungeon, and it's that same character taunting the players the same way. So obviously that made enough of an impression that there's been a long legacy and wanting to reuse exactly that undead taunting villain like that. It made a big impression.
If I were to ding it then on one thing, I would say that his final appearance is, I think, kind of anticlimactic. And if I were like running Tomb of Horrors as the end cap to a campaign, or just I had players who were playing a campaign play rather than just a one-off tournament, this is sort of funny how we're going to watch our characters die. I would be tempted to replace it with something more like what Lucien had, of like an actual nasty, horrible lich at the end.
When you started that sentence, that thought that light bulb went off for me. I think that's a fairly good idea. Would you consider using the Sphere of Annihilation the same way?
Yes, that's yeah. Why not? It's great.
Yeah, that might be a better ending.
Awesome.
There's a little bit of a screw you. Of like, oh, there's no actual lich here, haha. But for actual like tactical element, I think that using Lucien's version might be better actually.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so do you have maybe that that's we, so this is obviously a big subject.
Yeah.
It's a rich series, a rich version of these adventures. The illustrations are great. Any final thoughts on Tomb of Horrors?
I don't think so. I think it's, it's a really interesting module. I think that I would make sure just to go in with the right expectations with your players if you're going to run it. Definitely, if you can get your hands on that reproduction of the original tournament module and Lucien's module, which came with the art book, I'm personally actually honestly really tempted. If I was going to run one thing, I'm now thinking I'm leaning towards the original Tomb of Rahotep. Again, it's surprising. It's kind of nasty, but it's also a little more traditional. I think that would be a good fun game to run.
And I think it probably fits better time-wise into a standard convention session, which is something I've certainly been wrestling with for a long time. I think both of us have. And it probably fits better time-wise there,
too. Oh, my gosh. How did they ever fit Tomb of Horrors in the original tournament timeline? I can't imagine.
That plus other original tournaments are just this continual confusing mystery to me that I just cannot figure out. And that's one of them, yeah. Yeah. And so for me, my final thought would be if you are the DM and you're going to run Tomb of Horrors, give the riddle! You've got to give the riddle the start. It's a totally different play experience.
Yeah.
Great. And if you're a player and you have watched through this and ignored our spoiler warner, search for the riddle at the start.
Awesome. Well, if anyone else has any thoughts on Tomb of Horrors, wants to leave some comments for us here in the video, that'd be great. We've got a lot to say about it. We would love to hear your thoughts, your experiences having played it or run it, or just questions about how one might go about doing so. Leave us some comments and we'll be happy to reply.
And as always, please subscribe to our channel on YouTube, the Wandering DMs channel. That does help us out a lot. We are live every other Sunday at 1 p.m. So please come back in 2 weeks and join us for another thought-provoking discussion. We will talk to you next time.
See you then.